We are in Matthew 26. By the way, I said I was going to cover verses 1 through 35. I was wrong. It was a little too big of a section. I think I was a little zealous, as I sometimes am. And I started looking at the overall size of the passage, and I thought, well, let's slow down a little bit here. So we're only going to cover Matthew 26, verses 1 through 16 this evening. So we're going to deal with a little bit of a smaller section, as we'll see here in the notes. But before we go to Matthew 26, I want to read John chapter 12. John chapter 12, we'll read verses 1 through 8 because this is a parallel passage. And sometimes when you're reading a section, if you read a parallel passage, you get little tidbits of information that you get from another section that helps fill in the gaps. And I assume everybody has read this section, studied it, listened to audio lectures, looked at their commentaries and whatever Greek reference works they have on their shelves, so everybody's all studied up. So the things that I will tell will just sort of fill in a little gap here and there. I know you all are very studious. So John chapter 12, so I don't keep yak-yakking. John chapter 12, verse 1. It says, Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So we have the location here. And by the way, and I've mentioned this several times before, and it's one of the things that we always have to keep in mind when we're thinking about Jesus, when we read through the biblical text, is that as we read through the Bible was written as historical narrative, as historical narrative. So as we read through these passages, we're looking at something that deals with time and space. And we have here the reference to 6 days before the Passover, an historical event, where Jesus came to Bethany. Again, we're dealing with geographical locations. So when we see Jesus here, Jesus is being treated how? As a real person, a historical person who lives in time, who lives in space, right? He's not just a mythical, religious person, as the world often wants to treat him, but the Bible puts him in real time, real space, and that's exactly how he needs to be treated as the Scripture treats him. But it says, Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving. But Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Now here's Lazarus. He had died, remember the account. And 4 days later, Jesus comes and he calls Lazarus forth from the tomb. Quite an experience, right? I'm sure for Lazarus, right, to have died and then to have come back from death. To come out of the grave and to have been unwrapped, and for those who had dealt with the grieving process, and then here he is again, I'm sure they were just thrilled to Martha and Mary to have their brother Lazarus back, and here they are, they're reclining at the table with him. And then verse 3 it says, Mary took a pound of very costly perfume. And so now we have the name Mary here given to us, took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, said, now here we have two different groups of people, don't we? We have Martha, Mary, Lazarus, three people who love the Lord. But then we have Judas here. Now, Judas, it's already been identified as the person who's going to betray him. Said, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? So now we're given the price of this perfume. Now, a denarii was equal to a day's wage. Was equal to a day's wage. You have a friend over there, don't you? Okay. Yeah. So now, Judas asked the question, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? So this tells us something about the worth of the perfume, doesn't it? Okay. Now, if you take this 300 denarii, what you would have, in effect, And that's about probably about, there's probably about 300 work days in a year, right? So what you have is you have about an annual salary, is what this perfume would have been worth. Now that's some pretty pricey perfume. Now I've never seen perfume that expensive. But take your annual salary and go online and shop and see if you can find some perfume that price. I've shopped in some stores, but I've never seen anything quite that price. But now Judas asks the question, and by the way, it seems like a pretty pious question, doesn't it? He says, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? Now, on the surface, if you're in the room and you hear this question, it seems like a pretty pious question, doesn't it? Genuine concern for the poor. But notice what John says here. He says, now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, right? So outwardly he poses this seemingly religious, pious question as though he's really genuinely concerned about the poor. But is he really? He's not, is he? But what was he really concerned about? It's not that he was really concerned about the poor, but because he was what? A thief.
Money.
Yeah, oh yeah.
See,
does he really care about the poor? The answer is no. But because he was a thief and he had the money box and he used to pilfer what was put in it. So he really wasn't concerned about the poor. He was upset because this bottle of perfume was not sold for 300 denarii and he couldn't finger his 10%. Right? He couldn't lift his 10 or 15% or whatever it was that he could take out of the bag for his own personal pocketbook. Okay? So beware of people who use religious language and often talk about helping the poor. Okay? Because sometimes people who use that language may in fact have ulterior motives. And Judas here is a good example of that. And Jesus, therefore, verse 7, therefore Jesus said, let her alone, that she may keep it for the day of my burial. Now, she's already poured some of it on Jesus, and she's already used it to wipe his feet with her hair. Now, we're going to learn from Matthew that she didn't just pour it on his feet, but from Matthew, we're also going to learn that she poured it on his head as well. But he says, let her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial, for you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. Okay, and that is one happy dog. Okay, now let's move over to our text in Matthew here, because we have some details from John, so let's move over to Matthew now.
This is the Mary that Jesus loved the most and later as a child with.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah, from all the other accounts. Yeah, right, yeah. Right, yeah. Okay, so Matthew 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished all these words. Now in Matthew here, he picks up from the context where it says, when Jesus had finished all these words, which words are we talking about? We're talking about the prophecies given in Matthew 24 and 25. This is the sections we just spent the last few months working through where we talked about the prophecies of the time of the tribulation and the second coming of Christ and some of the judgments associated with that. Okay? So these, if you remember that Matthew 24 and 25 deal in their entirety with the second coming, with the tribulation, and the second coming of Christ, it says, when Jesus had just finished all these words, he said to his disciples, then in verse 2 it says, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming. So now here we have the context of some events that are about to transpire. And by the way, Jesus knows exactly what is coming. He knows exactly what is about to happen, right? He has a timetable in his mind. There is a sense of certainty, isn't there, about events that are coming. By the way, when we think of the Passover is a holiday celebrating Israel's salvation from Egyptian captivity, isn't it? Let's understand what this holiday celebrates. When we think of the Passover, what is that event? What is the Passover event?
The dead angel passing over.
Yes, right? So we go back circa 1445 BC, and we have Israel in Egyptian captivity, right? And God is pronouncing judgment upon the nation of Israel, and they are to, you have certain groups of people in Egypt who sacrifice the Passover lamb, and they put the blood upon the doorposts, right? And when the death angel passes over, those who do not have blood upon the doorposts, right? The firstborn son in the house dies, right? But when the death angel passes over, those who did put the blood upon the doorpost, their firstborn son is spared, right? So this is a time of celebration, because what happens afterwards? Pharaoh finally gives up, and he finally says, get out of Egypt. And it's the event that marks their liberation, their time of freedom from captivity, from bondage, in which they leave Egypt and they then go out and are freed from captivity. So the time of the Passover is a time of celebration in which they are delivered from captivity. So, and by the way, they also sacrificed the Passover lamb, didn't they? They sacrificed the Passover lamb. Now, Jesus Christ himself is the Passover lamb, isn't he? And I think of in John chapter 1, verse 29, where when John the Baptist sees Christ, what does he say? He says, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And so the timing here is so precise. He says here again in verse 2, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be handed over for crucifixion. Now, Jesus is absolutely certain about the events that are coming, and there's a sense of control over the events that are about to happen. He is completely aware of what's coming. Now, by the way, go with me over to Acts chapter 2, verse 23. Acts chapter 2, verse 23. When we think about the crucifixion of Christ, we must understand that the events that are transpiring here involve two wills. It involves the will of God and the will of men. The will of God and the will of men. That both are intersecting simultaneously. Now, from Christ's perspective, he is operating from the divine viewpoint. When you hear Christ stating these words, he is absolutely certain of what is going to happen and when it's going to happen, right? Because he says, you know that after 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man is to be handed over for crucifixion. Is there certainty as to the time and the event in his words? And the answer is yes. Now, we're about to see the priests here, on the other hand, and the people. We're about to see their uncertainty in their words. But in Acts 2:23, let me read this. It says, this man, referring to Jesus, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Stop. When Jesus Christ was handed over for crucifixion, the first part of this verse makes it very clear that he was delivered over, how? By the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. In other words, when Christ was delivered over, it was according to God's predetermined plan. Was it according to God's plan that Christ go to the cross? Absolutely. In other words, Christ going to the cross was not an accident. It was according to God's predetermined plan and his foreknowledge. But then read the latter part of the verse. Talking to the men of Israel, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. Is there a responsibility on the hands of the godless men who put him there? The Israelites and the Romans? Yes. There is culpability. Both are true. There is a simultaneous truth in the sense that God is absolutely sovereign, and yet these men are free to engage in their evil activity to put Christ upon the cross. That both are simultaneously true, that God is sovereign, and these men are free to act in such a way so as to put Christ upon the cross. And you really get this kind of played out in the narrative of the text right here. Because Christ knows that in 2 days he's going to be delivered over and he's going to be put upon the cross. He knows that. He states that. There's certainty in his words, right? But look at verse 3. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas. And what are they doing? And they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and do what? Kill him. So what do you have in these two verses? You have Jesus articulating the predetermined plan of God. And in verse 3, you have the activity of these evil men conspiring. It hasn't happened yet, but they're conspiring in their minds to put him to death. Now, they've already rejected him. They could not destroy him with their words, so now they're resorting to violence to put him to death. What they could not destroy with their language, they are now willing to resort to words in order to stop him because he's that much of a threat to them. So then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, verse 4, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and to kill him. By the way, they're gathering together in the court of the high priest. What's sad about this is the one place where you would expect to see justice. This is the one place where you would expect to see truth. And you would expect to see justice. And what do you see? Deception and a plot for murder.
Power corrupts?
Huh?
Is it power corrupts?
Well, in this case it does.
Right.
Now, Jesus has power too. And we see that, for example, in John chapter 19.
What if I
repeat
the power corrupts the flesh?
The immature, maybe. Because for a mature person, they have the capacity to handle it. But for an immature person, the very thing that they desire becomes the very thing that destroys them.
Yeah.
It's like money is power. And if you give a lot of money to a very immature person, which often the immature desire great wealth, but often the very thing that they desire becomes the very thing that will destroy them because they lack the capacity really to handle it.
Self-control.
Right. They lack the responsibility. They lack the maturity. They lack the control. Often, you know, whether you're talking about money or authority or power, it really takes a certain amount of maturity to be able to have the capacity to handle those sorts of things. And often, the very thing a person wants can be the very thing that will destroy him if he's not mature enough to handle it. And that's what happens with a lot of people when they get something that is very powerful or get into a position of power. And I think of in Jesus where he's standing before Pilate. Remember that in John 19:10, when Jesus stands before Pilate and Pilate says to him, "You do not speak to me." Remember, Jesus isn't saying a word. Right? What's he going to say? He's not going to try to deliver himself. He knows where he's going, and he knows why he's going there. And Pilate's hitting him with all sorts of questions. And Jesus isn't answering him. Verse 9 says that. It says Jesus gave him no answer. Verse 10, John 19:10, so Pilate said to him, "You do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you, and I have authority to crucify you?" Now, that's a pretty confident statement, right? Right? He's speaking assertively. Verse 11, Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above." Okay? Now, that's a pretty confident and assertive statement as well. But Jesus knows where ultimate authority lies. And he knows that if the man in front of him is going to put him upon a cross, it's only because the sovereign God of the universe is permitting it. Okay? Or bringing it to pass. So God, Christ knows exactly who's controlling the events, the circumstances of his life. Okay? So even the evil, even the injustice that is going on around him, Christ knows exactly who is in absolute complete control and why these things are happening. Okay? He knows that there is a purpose for these things. Okay? So going back to the context here, then the chief priests and the elders of the people, verse 3, were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and to kill him. But their motivation is hatred. They hate Christ. Verse 5, but they were saying, and they're saying this, they say, not during the festival, otherwise a riot might occur among the people. Now, they're uncertain about the events, but really, they're not in control. They are not in control. Now, they do not want him to be arrested or put to death during the time of the festival, and yet that's exactly when he's going to be put to death. So now they're trying to control the circumstances, but isn't it interesting? They're not in control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They are not in control of the events, the circumstances. They're not even in control of the mode of death. Even when they go to put Jesus to death, they can't do it. Who has to do it? The Romans. The Romans have to put him to death because even they're not in control of that. Who's in control? God is. Christ is. So we'll talk about this the more that this begins to unfold. Verse 6. Now when Jesus was in Bethany, now we have this shift to this event in this home. Now when Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, and we already read the account in John, a woman, and we know this to be Mary, came to him with an alabaster vial, a very costly perfume, which we know cost 300 denarii, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. But the disciples were indignant when she saw this. Now in Matthew it just simply says that the disciples were indignant. But we know from John 12:4 that Judas was the one who really spoke up, wasn't it? That Judas was the one who spoke up. But isn't it interesting here in Matthew it says that the disciples were indignant. So apparently Judas spoke up, but they were all apparently bothered by what they saw. Apparently they were all bothered by what they saw. Okay? So the disciples were indignant when they saw this and said, why this waste? Why this waste? Verse 9. For this perfume might have been sold for a high price. And we know from John, again, that was 300 denarii, a year's wage. And the money given to the poor. And of course we know from John 12:6, and stolen in part by Judas. Right? Now again, on the surface, this sounds like very noble language. It sounds, you know, let's help the poor, very practical language. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. Now, Jesus corrects them, doesn't he? Doesn't he? Because he says, why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. And then in verse 12 it says, for when she poured this out on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Now that's an interesting statement there, because according to the words of Christ, he says, for when she poured this out on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Now the impression I get is that how many times had Christ stated that he was going to the cross to die? Well, this most recent account would make four. Now, I get the impression that the disciples were like in one ear and out the other. That they really weren't listening.
Not until you have to like flat out put it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I get the impression here that Mary has been listening. I get the impression that Mary is doing this in two ways. One, as an expression of worship, but I also get that what she's doing is an act of faith. Because when Jesus says that she is doing this to prepare me for burial, she knows he's going to die. And I get that what she's doing is an anticipation, that it's a genuine expression of faith on her part. Because she takes the words of Christ and she has absorbed them, and her expression here is not only an expression of worship, it is an expression of faith. And I think the disciples don't get it.
I think she got it because of what happened to her brother.
I would agree with you on that. I would agree with you on that. Yes. And Mary was, she was really, I think, I'll be honest, I think she got a lot more than the disciples got. You think of the account in Luke where her and Martha had the difference, where she was sitting at Jesus' feet and Martha was washing the dishes, and Martha gets upset and says, comes to Jesus and says, tell her to come help me. And Jesus says, no, she's chosen the better thing, right? Because she sits, she's learning. And time learning the word is more important than time washing the dishes. And here we have another example. Because here we have a contrast between worshiping the Lord or practically helping the needy in the community. And what does Jesus say is the greater act? Both are important. I mean, let's not set these as extreme opposites. Both have a valid place. But when it comes to practically helping the needy or worshiping the Lord, what does Jesus give the priority to? Worshiping the Lord. Because you always have the poor with you. And by the way, isn't this really an extravagant act? I mean, she's pouring out a pretty costly bottle of perfume here, right? And the disciples are pretty upset by it. You know, they think it's a little over the top. But Jesus does not stop her at all. What are his words? What are his words? He says, why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. Right? For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. For when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial.
Part of her customs also was Jewish customs.
Mm-hmm.
As far as...
The preparation?
Yeah. Preparation for burial. She's doing it while he's still physically alive. She knows what's going to happen. And also with sometimes it's easier to get things when you're not always talking like the disciples.
Yeah, and they prepared the bodies very quickly. I mean, they didn't have embalming like we do. I mean, so when they prepared the body, I mean, when a person died, I mean, it was very quick to prepare the body. What's interesting is Jesus memorializes her act, doesn't he? He gives it such high value in verse 13. It says, truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her. And I thought about that statement for several days, and it really kind of struck me, I think, late Thursday, thinking about it all week, but it really kind of struck me late Thursday, that when he says, truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, that statement is a pregnant statement, that it's loaded. Because what does that assume? It assumes the gospel message will go out, doesn't it? That Christ will die, but that what? He'll be raised, doesn't it? He hasn't even died yet. And what is Christ already stating? That wherever this gospel goes out, that what this woman has done, that when the gospel goes out, I mean, he's already certain about what?
His resurrection.
His resurrection. Yeah, there's a loaded statement, isn't it? And so he says here, truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, and it assumes the good news of the resurrection, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her. And how was that accomplished? Because it was recorded in Scripture. Exactly. Because what she has done has been inscripturated. It has been put within the Word of God. And read by how many? Obviously us here today, right? So here we have this beautiful passage in memory of this beautiful woman who has done this beautiful thing for the Lord. Right?
It's also it's like eerily true, like for me in a way, for like how I differentiate between the two Marys when I was younger was it was Mary his mom and Mary the one that poured perfume.
You're right.
Like,
yeah.
That's something I remember.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's like a prophecy that knows it's fulfilled, you know?
Yes.
It's something that Jesus said will happen. And,
that's a good point. Yeah, good point, because it was a prophecy. It was something that he said would come to pass, and it did come to pass. You bet. Not only the gospel, not only the resurrection, his gospel, but the fact that the testimony of her act as being memorialized, as going out. And so here we have it. But notice the negative response. The negative response, because now we have verse 14. Then one of the 12, and this would be Judas, and here he's apparently motivated by sinful greed. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to betray him to you?" Now let's stop for just a second and think about this. Because you get the idea that if you follow the flow of the text, I mean context, right? What just happened? There and there, there at this meal, Mary comes in, she breaks this bottle of ointment, this perfume, pours it upon Jesus. John says his feet, Matthew says his head, both are true, okay? So she's pouring it upon Jesus, right? The disciples get upset. We know it's provoked by Judas, right? But the whole disciples get upset. Said, why wasn't it sold for 300 denarii, given to the poor? Judas is thinking, I want my fingers in the pocketbook. He gets upset. But then, looking at verse 14, one of the 12 named Judas Iscariot went to the chief priest, verse 15, and said, what are you willing to give me to betray him to you? What's his motivation? Why is he now upset? He felt like he got shorted, didn't he? Do you think that event may have triggered?
Well, I suppose he was fed up with it.
Yes. Yeah. It was the line in the sand, as it were. It was the one thing that he finally, he said, that's it, I've had enough. That he was motivated here by sinful greed, said, what are you willing to give me to betray him to you? And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him.
A really interesting point right there, the 30 shekels of silver, or 30 pieces of silver,
uh-huh.
which in Jewish tradition was the amount that you would pay for a slave.
Yes, it was the price of a slave.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, according to the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is this more than 300 denarii?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it would be, yeah. Yeah. But it was basically the 300 shekels of silver was the price of a slave. I don't know exactly how that comes out as far as the 300 denarii. But for Judas, I think it was his feeling shorted was the motivation behind it. And I think that's kind of the point. Because they don't really say how much. They just simply says they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him.
That, and after he made such a big deal about it, then Jesus was like, well, wait a minute. I'm sure, you know, that would even make him feel more, like, you know, humiliated.
Yes.
Humiliation.
Yeah, because he feels rebuffed. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. He didn't have the heart of worship that Mary had. Because the heart of worship is sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And for Mary to give up a year's salary to express herself, to pour out this ointment and to wipe his feet with her hair. To her, this is nothing. She loves the Lord. He is her Savior. And she restored, he restored her brother to her. They're at the table. They're dining together. I mean, for her, this is a fragrant aroma that says, I would give you 10 times this if I had it to you. I mean, she loves him. And she's willing to sacrifice. This is nothing to her. It's nothing to her. And Judas does not have the heart of sacrifice. He does not have that heart of love. It's just not part of who he is. He's in it for what he can get, not what he can give. And that's the difference between the two. And so when he feels shorted, he leaves. He leaves the presence of the one that she would not dare leave because she loves him. But he leaves. And where does he go? He goes to find the presence of those who hate him, who are not concerned about truth or justice, but only want to kill him. And he goes and he aligns himself with them. And he is ready to engage in injustice and betrayal. And soon as we move through the next few sections in Matthew, what are we going to find? We're going to find Judas sitting at the table with the Lord at the Last Supper. And we're going to find Judas himself engaging in deception. Because Jesus is going to openly state, one of you is going to betray me. Isn't it? And then all of a sudden the discussion is going to erupt amongst the disciples. Oh, not me, not me, not me. And what's Judas going to say? It's not me, is it?
I'd be so nervous if I were just like, he can read my mind, he can read my mind.
Yeah.
but Judas chimes right in, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's not I, is it? And he chimes right in. But now what is he using? He's using deceptive language, isn't he? He's now using deceptive language just like the people with whom he's aligned himself. Because he's now crossed over. He's now part of that same group. And here he is sitting at the table, sharing a meal. Somebody with whom he should be engaged with intimately. A what?
A bad company.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, let's move on here. I've got some good quotes. I have a quote here from Charles Ryrie from an article that he wrote. And it's on this comment here where Jesus says, "For the poor you have with you always." Ryrie says, "At Bethany, Jesus uttered the well-known statement, 'For you have the poor with you always.'" He says, by this he affirmed the inevitability of poverty as a social phenomenon. He says, the statement should never be understood callously, as if Christ were saying one need never concern himself with the alleviation of poverty. In effect, Christ was saying that opportunities always exist to do something for the poor, but not always to do what had just been done to him since he was about to be put to death. To put it another way, Jesus was saying that on that occasion, an extravagant gift, a perfumed ointment, was more appropriate than a donation to the poor. And there he's quoting from Larry Christensen. Ryrie goes on to say, Jesus' statement furnishes a second principle. The mere presence of poverty does not necessarily constitute a call to action to alleviate that poverty. For if poverty alone constituted a call to action, then no Christian could justify having anything but the barest necessities of life, since the poor are constantly everywhere. And I thought that was an interesting statement that he would make. He goes on then to say, basically, if it did necessitate a call to action, then basically we could never justify eating steak or hamburgers. Basically, we would have to get by working all the time and getting by on the barest necessity, eating just sort of flakes and rabbit food and that sort of stuff. And anyway, it's an interesting point, though. But I thought it was worth putting into the context there. All right, well, let's take up some summary points here on the passage, and then we'll have some further discussion as well. The central idea of the text is that Jesus foretells the time and manner of his death. He foretells the time and manner of his death, and he's done this several times as well, as we've looked at before. Matthew then records an event of worship that occurred 4 days earlier in the house of Simon the leper, which event led Judas to betray Jesus. Now, I pulled some quotes here from the Gospel of John, but let me finish this last statement here. The events of Jesus' life and death were completely under the sovereign control of heaven. And that's an important point to remember, always to keep in mind, that when we think about the life of Christ and the events leading up to the cross, that all of these events were predetermined according to the plan of God the Father, that none of these things were ever outside of his plan. And there's a series of quotes here, comments that I have from the Gospel of John, and I put these here in here. If you think of when Christ began his ministry in the Gospel of John, several times he makes the comment, and I've covered these before, so this shouldn't be anything new to you. But there's several times that Jesus makes the comment where he says, my hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. Always referencing the time of the cross. Like in John 2:4, he says, my hour has not yet come. And then in John 7:30, he says, John says his hour had not yet come. And then again in John 8:20, he says his hour had not yet come. What's interesting is when you get to John 12:23, Jesus finally gets down to within days of the cross. And he says the hour has come for the Son of Man to be what?
Glorified.
Now he's talking about what? The cross. Now that's interesting language, isn't it? Because he doesn't say that the Son of Man, he doesn't say the hour has come for the Son of Man to be crucified, but that's exactly what he's talking about. But he says the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Because that's exactly what the cross will produce. John 12:27, my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I came to this hour. For this purpose I came to this hour. And he clearly recognizes that his life was bringing him to this very point. For this purpose I came to this hour. Now, is he struggling?
Yes.
In his humanity, is he struggling? Sure he is. There's no denying that. He says, my soul has become deeply troubled. He knows what he's facing. And yet, he's going to face it. He's going to face it. And then John 13:1, Jesus knowing that his hour had come. And then John 17:1, Father, the hour has come. And by the time you get to John 17:1, you're literally within 18 hours of the cross. You're literally within about 18 hours of the cross. And so you're right down to just not even within a full 24-hour time frame at that point. So I would love to teach you the Gospel of John sometime, maybe in the future sometime. But when you trace through the chronology of the Gospel of John, you see the words that Christ uses. He's very clear on these things. Point number two, the Jewish leadership who were celebrating Passover, and this is the irony to me, and the freedom that it symbolized, were the same ones who planned to crucify their liberator. Do you see the contradiction there?
Mm-hmm.
I'll read it again. The Jewish leadership who were celebrating the Passover and the freedom it symbolized were the same ones who planned to crucify their liberator. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Right?
Sounds
yeah. It's like, hello? You know, you're shooting, you're crucifying your own liberator. You're crucifying the Messiah. Ah, man. Anyway. Sometimes those who proclaim and celebrate freedom because of their arrogance may be the same who bring slavery to themselves and others. And that's exactly what we have here. Because these leadership, these people, were the ones who were to the people proclaiming to celebrate freedom, is who they were, and yet because of their arrogance, they were the very ones who were bringing slavery to themselves and to the nation. That's who they were, because of their arrogance. Amazing. Point number three, Mary loved the Lord. She loved the Lord Jesus. And this is the thing, is you have these pockets of people, you have these individuals and pockets of people who love the Lord, who follow the Lord, and were with him. Now, we are going to get to this point as we follow also on, if you read on through Matthew 26. Remember, Jesus also tells the disciples that he's going to be betrayed and that they're going to deny him. And what's the response? We're never going to deny you, Lord. right? Never going to deny you. Right? Yeah. They're all going to scatter.
Yeah.
Right? But they make the comment. They say, we're never going to deny you. Right? We'll even follow you to death. I mean, Peter says, I'll follow you to death. And all the rest of the disciples say, yes, we'll die with you. Right?
They will, just not then.
Yeah, right. Not then. But that's what you call an untested statement. Because at the moment they say those words to the Lord, they say, we'll never deny you. We'll follow you to death. Did they mean it?
Yes.
Were they sincere?
Yes.
And yet what does Jesus say? You'll deny me three times. Yeah, to Peter he did, right? So within a few days, all of their sincerity, all of their passion, all of their enthusiasm, what happened? Crumbled and went away, right? But how many times have we done that?
Yeah.
How many times have we made sincere, passionate statements only within a very short period of time just to realize we didn't have the integrity to back up the words that we threw out there?
Every New Year's resolution.
What?
Said every New Year's resolution.
Every New Year's resolution. Which I had somebody at work send me a thing that, because we were all supposed to send in and email in our New Year's resolution, and mine was that my New Year's resolution is not to have any more New Year's resolutions. Which I was then labeled a dork. So I said, I accept your label. Whatever. So, but, you know, as you read on through that section, you realize that as Jesus begins to deal with the disciples, that, you know, he's going to be dealing with their integrity. And he's going to be challenging them. And, you know, it's one thing to, you know, to make these sorts of claims, you know, to say I will do this or I won't do it. And we do it all the time, don't we? I mean, people make all sorts of promises, you know, whether they make them at the altar or whether they make them in relationships or they make them at work or they make friendship promises or they make all sorts of promises that they make in life. But, you know, those are untested statements. You know, I'll be there, I promise, I'll do this, I'll do that. Only within short time to fail. And they can even be made sincerely, passionately, with tears in your eyes. I'll always do this thing for you. Well, you know, that's nice. But let the trial come. You know, let the fire fall and let's see if you're really test. Stand up. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry.
No, good.
But I definitely think that you think it was necessary because Jesus, you know, he tells Peter, Simon, you know, Satan has asked permission to sift you like wheat.
Oh, yes.
But when you return to me, strengthen your brothers.
Yes.
So it's like, it's sad that they would be like, yeah, and they would be scattered, but then it leads them to repentance and growth.
Yes.
You know, at least them, and I mean, not Judas, but them, you know
right.
what I mean?
Right. And you know, sometimes it takes the failure to reveal the fragile heart. You know, sometimes it takes the failure to reveal just how fragile our heart is and just how vulnerable we are. Because sometimes we think we're really strong and we're not. We are not. You know, and it's only when Paul had his thorn in the flesh that he finally realized, when I'm weak, I'm strong. You know, and the reality is if you think you're strong, you're automatically weak. If you know you're weak, you can become strong when you turn to the Lord. That's the truth of it, okay? But that's something we often have to learn through experience, okay? And that's where experience is sometimes one of the best teachers in the world. So we come to Mary. You know, Mary loved the Lord and at times had greater faith than those around her. Mary, this beautiful, brilliant woman, you often don't hear much about. Right? But she was faithful to sit at the feet of Christ and to learn. She was the one who had the expression of worship when pouring out the perfume on the Lord. Right? Here's Mary, who's at the tomb, right? When the Lord is resurrected, she was among the first of the women to be there, right? And here's this woman who I think had tremendous doctrine in her soul, who loved the Lord and who was loved by the Lord. And I think she is often overlooked, but I think she's one of the invisible heroes.
Definitely a follower.
Oh, yes, definitely a disciple. And I got some scripture references in there that you can chase down if you like. Apparently, she took him at his word and believed him when he spoke about his death. As an expression of worship, she poured out expensive perfume upon Jesus to prepare him for his burial. Judas and the other disciples were angry and objected to Mary's act with superficial piety, saying, "Why this waste? For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor." However, Jesus approved of her act, saying, "Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me." And I think that their words were a superficial piety compared to hers. Especially Judas, because he really didn't mean it, did he? When he said, "Oh, why could this money be sold to the poor? Right, given to the poor." Was he really concerned about the poor? The answer is no. He really wasn't. What was he concerned with? Stealing. Because he was a thief. Right?
And it's really surprising. I mean, like the disciples, if they know he is God, I mean, why they will even be concerned about the poor? I mean, he can, like...
I know.
Why you are talking about the... You know, I'm just
right.
saying that...
Right.
Spending the time with the man, though. I guess.
Well, I think
I
think there may be several things at play here. One, and I think one is I think Judas was the first to speak up. Two, I think the disciples kind of thought, you know, that's really a good point. I think they just kind of went along with Judas. And three, I think, and I'm just talking just kind of more sensibly here. I think. Practically speaking, what the disciples suggested had more practical application, whereas what Mary did seemed really quite extravagant, didn't it? And you know, it just I just don't think it quite fits in the mindset of a lot of people to do that sort of thing.
I think one thing maybe too I credit the disciples. You made the point that Mary, as opposed to the disciples, was really intent on listening to what he had to say, and that his death was coming. I think, in other occasions as well, that after having spent so much time with him, that they kind of became a little bit callous to certain things. And so there was so much truth that we'd speak every word out of his mouth, and I think when we spend time even with people every day, that sometimes we'll just miss, you know, certain key elements.
Yes. Yes.
I think maybe they had just become... I don't know if callous is really the right word.
Desensitized.
That's a little bit more what I was getting at.
And that may very well be part of it, that they were desensitized to some of what he said. I've scratched my head at the disciples. They seem a little thick to me. I just don't get it sometimes, because he would just go over and over and over. And I think sometimes he got frustrated, because there were times that Christ said, you know, "How long am I going to be with you guys? You know, I've told you what, how many times, and you still don't get it? I mean, you know, come on, guys. You know, how long am I going to be with you?" You know, so, I mean, you really get the sense of frustration at times, even in the Lord's words, you know, when he was with him. So
I think it's really awesome, though, because often, I mean, we read the scriptures, and all of this time has passed, and then we're people living today.
Mm-hmm.
And just like he had said to Thomas, whenever he was doubting, he was like, "Blessed are those who don't see me and still believe." Because they were with him face to face, and we're not with him face to face.
Yeah.
And he was constantly dealing with their faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we get this example, and we get something to look back on and be like, okay, whenever I'm this way, just like the disciples, God's patient with me too. You know, it's another chance, it's another chance, it's another, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's grace.
Yes.
Constant grace, and it's... like we're talking about your post, other people looking on that and going, okay, now I get a different perception of that, different insight of that, different, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's a growing tool. It's a learning tool.
It is. And sometimes when I look at the scripture too, I have to ask myself at times, with whom do I identify?
Yeah.
When I'm looking at this passage, when you're looking at a passage here and you're asking the question, you know, and I'm reading here and I'm reading through the passage, I put myself in the room. You know, do I identify with Mary?
Yeah.
Do I identify with the disciples? You know, would it have been better to sell and give it to the poor? Yeah, that's an awful lot of money spent on a bottle of perfume to pour out, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, that's a year's salary, you know. And I work hard for my money, you know, a lot of money.
Depends
on
your value.
Exactly, because what you value,
yeah,
right, you're going to put yourself into.
And
right,
your treasure.
Right. And so, you know, you really have to think about it. Put yourself in the moment. Mary here lost her brother. A few days earlier, the Lord had just brought him back to life. She had the conversation with him in the preceding chapter in John 11, which I read. And here she comes to him. She falls at his feet. She worships. You know, there's this discussion about Jesus being the resurrection and the life. I mean, she loves the Lord. She's theologically astute. I mean, you listen to the conversations this woman has with the Lord. She is savvy. I mean, she's got some theology up in her brain, man. And I mean, you know, so I read a lot about Mary. I read through the passages, and then you come to this section over here, and you think, okay, this woman's got it going on. So you don't so much have her words, but she shows up in the context, and what's she doing? It's what she's doing. It's this expression of worship. She's pouring herself out. Okay?
Right. Our actions more than our words.
Right. So what she's doing is a reflection of who she is and what's going on. And Jesus, you have to understand who she is in the light of how Jesus commends her. Because even though the disciples are upset, Jesus is not. Jesus praises her. Jesus commends her. And Jesus memorializes her act. And in that's the final it. I mean, that's the final word. There's nothing more to be said. The disciples, zip. Put a clamp on it, boys, because that's the final word, right? Because once he finally says that what she has done will be remembered, right? Wherever the gospel is preached, what she has done will be remembered. I mean, that's it. I mean, he's given the final stamp of approval there, so... Let me read this final quote here by Dr. Barbieri. He says, Mary's beautiful act prepared his body for burial. And there he cites Matthew 26:12. Jesus had spoken several times of his coming death, but the disciples did not seem to believe his words. And I agree with Dr. Barbieri when he says, Mary believed and performed this act as a testimony of her devotion to him. As a result of her sacrificial act, is often proclaimed throughout the world. Perhaps it was this act and the Lord's approval of it that made Judas willing to betray the Lord. And from this scene, Judas went to the chief priests and offered to betray Jesus.